From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Carole King wrote many top 40 songs in the 60s for the Drifters, the Shirelles, Aretha Franklin. Then in the 70s, her own album, Tapestry, became the best-selling album of the decade. On today's Fresh Air, Carole King talks about her past hits and her latest album, City Streets. Also today, we talk with mystery writer Sue Grafton. She writes hard-boiled fiction starring a woman detective. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from cornetist Warren Vacher. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new miniseries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. East German legislators elected a new premier today and discussed the idea of free elections during an open debate that marked an abrupt departure from Parliament's usual role. The new prime minister, Hans Modrow, is considered to be reform-minded and likely will wield more clout than his predecessor, Willy Stoph, who resigned last week. Hundreds of thousands of people were in the streets tonight of Leipzig, pressing for further political reforms, NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
With the immense changes in East Germany of the past week, many here were wondering whether the demonstrations in Leipzig and other East German cities might begin to diminish. Not so tonight in Leipzig. The people of this city filled its main square, demanding free elections and more political rights. They spilled out of the square in huge numbers and took to the street that rings the city. As they passed the local headquarters of the secret police, they jeered and mocked the authorities. This is the third consecutive Monday that several hundred thousand people have taken to the streets here. They are determined to keep up the pressure on the Communist Party to force even more political change in East Germany. I'm Mike Schuster in Leipzig.
The White House rejected a suggestion today that President Bush visit Berlin in the near future. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said the United States should use this opportunity to advance the interest of the United States and the interest of freedom throughout the world. President Bush awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Polish political leader Lech Wałęsa in a White House ceremony today. Bush assured the Solidarity leader that American aid has begun and more is coming. Wałęsa arrived in Washington as the Senate reached a bipartisan compromise on a plan to give $657 million in aid to Poland and $65 million to Hungary. In the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip and West Bank territories, the Israeli army and Palestinians are gearing up for a confrontation this Wednesday. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
Israeli authorities in the occupied territories have indicated that heavy force will be brought to bear to keep demonstrations to a minimum when Palestinians celebrate the one-year anniversary of the declaration of an independent state. All of the refugee camps in the Gaza Strip will be under curfew starting on Tuesday, and all of the West Bank and Gaza Strip will be closed to journalists, a move which was considered unusual a year ago, but which has now become routine. The authorities also announced that schools in the occupied territories will be closed on November 15th, although they say there is no connection between the closure and the Palestinian Independence Day. Underground directives from the leadership of the Palestinian uprising have called for the raising of Palestinian flags and fireworks displays, activities which the Israeli authorities have declared illegal. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Government troops in San Salvador fired on leftist guerrillas from helicopter gunships in the suburbs of San Salvador today in their attempt to defeat a rebel offensive that has left at least 245 people dead in the heaviest fighting of the 10-year civil war. Stock prices were up fractionally. This is NPR News. The world's largest aircraft maker, Boeing Company, pleaded guilty today to two criminal charges of illegally using internal Pentagon planning documents. As part of the plea, Boeing will pay more than $5 million in fines and other expenses. The government charges grew out of a probe of a former Boeing marketing official, Richard Fowler, who at one time worked as an Air Force budget analyst. Federal District Judge T.S. Ellis criticized the plea bargaining agreement reached with federal prosecutors, saying the penalties do not appear to be severe enough. An international conference on AIDS is open in the Vatican in Rome. 1,500 scientists and theologians are discussing the moral as well as medical aspects of AIDS. But as the BBC's David Willey reports from Rome, there are big differences between the church and medical profession over ways to control the spread of AIDS.
The Pope's invited some of the world's leading scientific experts on AIDS, including Nobel Prize winners, to join bishops and theologians of the Roman Catholic Church for 3 days of discussions on AIDS prevention. At the end of the conference, the Pope will detail the moral objections of the Roman Catholic Church to current medical theories about curbing the spread of AIDS. Although scientists say that widespread use of condoms is the most effective way to stop the disease spreading, the Catholic Church's view is that this is morally wrong, just as the use of condoms for contraception is wrong. Rome's view is that people must change their sexual and moral behaviour in order to bring the disease under control. However, in some countries, including the United States and France, Roman Catholic bishops are not unanimous in their support for the church ban.
David Willey in Rome. U.S. Attorney Anton Valukas, who headed an elaborate undercover investigation that charged fraud and racketeering at Chicago's two futures exchanges, resigned today. Valukas was appointed during the Reagan administration. He said he will quit the Justice Department December 3rd and return to private law practice. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before Carole King had hit records of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers. Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, Don't Say Nothing Bad, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place?
That's from King's 1971 album, Tapestry, which remained on the charts for 6 years and broke the record for best-selling album of all time. None of her subsequent albums have approached the success of Tapestry, and King has somewhat removed herself from the record industry and public life by living on a ranch in Idaho. And Idaho is a long way from Brooklyn, where she grew up. Although she spends much of her time on her ranch, the city is the inspiration for King's new album, City Streets. It's her first record in 5 years. She told me why it's been so long.
I was actually waiting till I got it right. It just took me that long to accumulate a collection of songs that I felt was really worth putting out as an album.
Do you think that there are stylistic changes in this new record?
From the old things?
Yeah.
Definitely. This record is the first time that I've really felt comfortable rocking. I've always wanted to, but you know, the traditional image of me is the quiet, shy person behind the piano, and I've sort of come out from behind the piano. I play electric guitar now. I'm working with some of the really great rockers on this album: Max Weinberg, Eric Clapton, Steve Ferroni, Eric's drummer, and my co-producer Rudy Guess, and they're all. They all really inspired me to put a little more edge into my work.
You said you were uncomfortable rocking before. What made you uncomfortable with it?
You mean in the old days?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was like, I don't know what made me uncomfortable, but it was like putting on a new outfit and you're not sure if it looks good on you or not, and you're not really comfortable in it. It took time for me to get comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
playing guitar also helps.
Playing guitar, you're more up in front of the audience instead of sitting behind the piano.
Yeah, and you can use your instrument and move with it instead of sort of being stuck behind it.
Let's play something from the new record. This is City Streets, which is the title track and the song that also has a video. Do you want to say anything about writing this song?
I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I did live and feel and, you know, experience all the things that I'm writing about in this song, so it's very personal for me, and I hope that it's universal for other people.
Let's hear it. Carole King, City Streets, from her new album of the same name.
Gee, you cut it off before the Eric Clapton solo. They'll have to go out and buy it now to hear that.
You've actually been living on a farm in Idaho for the past few years, right?
Yeah, it's a ranch, and I've been there for, I don't know, about 8 years.
Why did you give up the city?
Too much stress, I think. I was really ready for a change and a place to recharge and be, you know, around nature, more nature, less people. Mm-hmm. But I found after a while that I missed the people. I kind of need both.
You got your start writing songs for other people. Now that you've been writing songs for yourself for the past couple of decades, is it easy to write for you?
I think in some ways it's harder to write for me. When I'm writing for somebody else, I mentally adopt the persona of that person, or my lyricist does, in the case when I write with Jerry Goffin, or we do it together. You kind of put yourself in the headset that you kind of think the other person is. They may not even be, but it's your perception of them. So it's sort of another dynamic that you can write towards. Whereas when I'm writing for myself, there isn't that extra thing. I'm just sort of writing as it comes out. And in some ways it's good, in other ways it's more difficult.
Well, Carole King, I want to play another record from your new album. The album's called City Streets. And this is your song, Down to the Darkness. You wrote music and lyrics for this. And speaking of darkness, I think this is one of the darkest songs you've written.
Yeah, I'm very proud of this one because I normally consider myself a gifted or whatever. I'm good at music, and I always feel like when I write lyrics, they just, it's not something I feel comfortable with saying, yeah, I'm really good at doing that. And this lyric I worked really hard on. I took a lot of time and crafted it and worked with the inspiration that I got for it. So I'm really especially proud of this lyric.
Let's give it a listen.
Out into the light of day.
Down to the Darkness from Carole King's new record, City Streets. Were you in that kind of mood when you wrote the record?
The whole record? Or you mean that cut?
No, that cut.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Was it about a relationship you were having? Or?
No, actually, it was somewhat inspired by the movie Blue Velvet, oddly enough.
Huh.
And a lot of times it's you can write a song by putting yourself in a hypothetical situation just as well as, you know, if it's really happening to you.
Did you write songs before you became a professional songwriter, when you were really young?
I've written some form of song since I was about 4 or 5. I really never wrote lyrics much until Tapestry was the first album that I started really writing lyrics, because Jerry Goffin is such a fine lyricist, and he's who I wrote with all the years when I had hits as a songwriter. I just, you know, didn't feel a need. And then when he and I split up, we didn't write together for a little while, and then we went back to writing together and remain friends. I say split up because it may or may not be well known, but we were married. And so we still write together and we're still friends. But in the interim period, I sort of learned to write lyrics myself, and I never really considered myself as good as he. And to this day, he is the master at lyrics. But that's what I meant when I said Down to the Darkness. To me, I feel for the first time I actually touched the kind of ability that he has at lyrics.
Were you aware of songwriters when you were growing up? I mean, most kids who grow up listening to pop or to rock and roll know the songs, they know the singers, they know the bands, but they don't necessarily know the songwriters.
Yeah, I was to some extent, not really in the pop world, but I went to a lot of Broadway shows, so I was aware of like Rodgers and Hammerstein and you know, people like that. And then when rock and roll was first being born with Chuck Berry, I was definitely aware of people like him, but he was, you know, the singer of his own songs, Jerry Lee Lewis.
You know, you were talking about Jerry Goffin, who was both your songwriting partner and your husband. There were several teams of couples who wrote lyrics together at around that time. There was Ellie Greenwich and
Jeff
Barry and Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann.
Yeah, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and Jerry and I were, you know, the best known groups. I guess there were other people that weren't married, but.
Were you friends together, or did you feel competitive with each other?
Both. I actually didn't know Jeff and Ellie real well. We did know Barry and Cynthia worked in the same office as Jerry and I, and we also went out socially together. And we really, really loved each other and still do to this day. But it was highly competitive, and it was, you know, that mixed feeling of like, well, I want to get the next record and not them,
right.
Or we want to get it. But still, when they got it, you would kind of be glad, because they almost always, if not always, deserved it.
When you started writing professionally, you and Jerry Goffin were working for, I think, a publishing company that was owned by Don Kirshner, the same Don Kirshner who produced The Monkees and who used to host those late-night rock shows on television.
This is Don Kirshner.
Can you set the scene for us? What was it like to turn out songs in an office building?
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home. Sometimes easier because, you know, we had the kids at home. But also in the office building, just as often, we'd have one of the kids in the room. One of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had 3 albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters
banging
out new tunes?
It's by now, you know, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and say Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments? You
know, always.
Like, what would an assignment be like?
Well, the Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit, and we want to get the next one. Donnie Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. You know, he was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donnie. He just, you know, he just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, you know, the melody, the
right.
lyrics, and everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was in fact a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, you know, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But you know, I always liked the fact that they were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter because it was happening.
I want to talk with you some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is singer and songwriter Carole King. She has a new album called City Streets. We'll hear more of it a little bit later. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer and songwriter Carole King is my guest. Her first hits were songs she wrote for other people, like Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, Up on the Roof, and A Natural Woman. When she started singing her own song, she came out with one of the best-selling albums of all time, Tapestry. She has a new record. It's called City Streets. When you were working with other groups, writing songs for them in the 60s, did you usually meet them, the singers and groups that you were writing for?
Not always, but generally, yeah, because we... Even if we weren't involved in the production, we'd often go to the sessions. We did.
What would you do if you felt that a singer or a group wasn't putting your song over right?
I don't think it ever happened.
Really?
I imagine if it did, not being shy about communicating my feelings about those kind of things, I probably found a way to let somebody know or make a suggestion. But I don't know. Usually they picked up the energy from the demo and, if anything, took it, you know, way farther. One of the great moments of my life as a songwriter was the first time that I heard Aretha Franklin's version of Natural Woman, which was, in many ways, not like the demo at all. It was amazing because this was the ultimate singer in the world to me, and she was singing my song, and she had taken what I did with it and did what I never dreamed could be done with it.
And so you were thrilled. Did you for a moment feel like it was no longer your song or something?
Oh, no, okay. Not at all. Uh-huh. It was my song taken to the nth power.
How did you feel recording that song after she did it?
I felt that, the idea of topping it didn't even cross my mind, but I felt that as the songwriter, I had sort of a claim on any version of it I wanted to do, and it would be okay because I wrote it. When I say I Jerry Goffin also co-wrote that. But it wasn't even a problem in my mind. It was like two very separate things. Nobody could even approach how she sang it, so that wasn't even in my mind.
After you and Jerry Goffin broke up, you started writing lyrics to your own songs. And you also started performing. What was it that got you in front of the microphone on stage and in the recording studio?
I don't know. I do know that it seemed inevitable. I did a record called Now That Everything's Been Said with a group called The City, which consisted of Charlie Larkey, my bass player and also second husband, and Danny Korchmar, who is, you know, now a well-known guitar player and producer and writer in his own right. And they just kept egging me on, come on, you can do it. And we never did go on the road with the city. We had we used Jimmy Gordon as a drummer on the record, but we just never did go on the road. But then I met James Taylor and started playing as a backup musician for him. And so I'd find myself on a stage with him. And one night he said, well, why don't you, you know, do one of your songs? And I was terrified. He said, no, no, it'll be fine. And in the middle of his set, he introduced me to his audience as the woman that had written a lot of their favorite hits. And he was going to turn the stage over to me, and we were good friends and all. And the audience, who loved him, was sort of ready to receive me and pre-liked me. So it was like, well, okay, they're ready to like me. I guess I'll do this. And it just was real easy. I really learned from James that all you have to do is get out there and be yourself and do the song. And, you know, it's okay. It's just the same as playing it for a few friends in a living room as it is for 20,000 people.
Was it stage fright and fear of not being liked that kept you out of performing until then?
Probably. Because I performed songs for people, you know, in a room, a few people at a time. I guess it was just the concept of being in front of all those people.
No, I would imagine that writing songs for so many years and seeing all these great groups and singers record them, that you'd get kind of envious and sometimes wish that it were you on that stage or selling all those records with your voice on it. You never felt envious of them?
I don't know if envious is the right word. Just at a certain point, writing the songs was the main thing. To write the song, to look at this thing and say, I did that, was great. And then getting on stage for me became less of a thing about glamour and glory, which I was actually more uncomfortable with than anything, the glamour and the glory. But it was the concept of, I guess I'm the best person to present my song, or I'm the only person to present my song at this time, or whatever. It just seemed like a way of presenting the song, but to me it was always about the song.
How do you think your voice has changed since Tapestry?
I think I've gotten better. Years of doing it, practice, I guess. I think I've gotten better and stronger and more confident. I didn't used to consider myself a singer. I would say, well, I'm just the songwriter, but let's turn it over to a real singer. And now I feel that I'm not technically real perfect. And in that regard, I mean, I still look up to people like Barbara Streisand and Whitney Houston as really, and of course Aretha, as real singers. But I feel that I'm also a real singer at this point. I feel that I'm in the league. I'm just not, you know, at that end of the league.
Do you think your voice has gotten a little huskier?
Oh, probably. And I don't even smoke.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Carole King.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
My guest has been singer and songwriter Carole King. Her latest album is City Streets. She'll perform at New York's Beacon Theater on November 18th, 20th, and 21st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Julia Child talks about bringing classic French cooking to Americans. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's cornetist Warren Vache, backed by the Beaux-Arts String Quartet from the new album Warm Evenings. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Vache's new album. Also, A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar. Sue Grafton's series of mystery novels is now up to F is for Fugitive. Coming up, Sue Grafton tells us how her revenge fantasies led her into crime writing. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new miniseries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Polish labor leader Lech Wałęsa is in Washington tonight, hoping to raise money for his country. This evening, he met with President Bush at a White House reception and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
President Bush praised Wałęsa as a man who made history by seizing freedom. As the president spoke, Wałęsa's eyes filled with tears. Wałęsa said, America is rich with freedom, and he said his country is on the road to freedom.
Polacy przecież znają cenę wolności.
Poles know the price of freedom.
Jak mało który naród świata.
As very few nations of the world.
Potrafią walczyć o wolność.
They know how to fight for freedom.
Potrafią bronić jej.
They know how to defend freedom.
Tomorrow, Wałęsa delivers a speech to the AFL-CIO's annual convention, and on Wednesday, he addresses a joint session of Congress. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
After a weekend in which millions of East Germans took advantage of their new freedom to visit the West, the East German parliament elected a leading reformer as the new prime minister and a non-communist speaker by secret ballot. But several hundred thousand protesters took to the streets of Leipzig to voice their beliefs that changes are moving too slowly. In Washington, the Bush administration maintained a cautious approach toward East Germany. Officials said that East Germans must hold free and fair elections to prove their intentions. Barry Schwide reports from the State Department.
Speaking at a Republican governor's conference at Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, Vice President Dan Quayle said German reunification is inevitable. Do away with a communist system in East Germany, Quayle said, and it's one Germany. Quayle accused the Democrats of having little but criticism of the administration to offer. But almost immediately, Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell unveiled a sweeping proposal. He said President Bush should go to Berlin to celebrate the destruction of the Berlin Wall, and that the president should extend trade credits to the Soviet Union. Within the administration, though, there's a disinclination to take too bold a stand on Eastern Europe. The theory is to have the West Europeans take the lead on German issues and not to say or do anything that appears to be taking advantage of the situation at the expense of the Soviet Union. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
In Europe, President Mitterrand of France has invited leaders of the 12 European community nations to a summit meeting this week to discuss recent events in East Germany. East Germany's Secretary of State says that his country would like to resume talks about a possible trade agreement with the European community. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up less than a point to close at 2,626.43 on volume of some 141 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new recording by jazz cornet player Warren Vache. Vache got his first big break in the late 1970s, playing with Benny Goodman. More recently, he's often been heard with tenor saxophonist Scott Hamilton. But Kevin says Vache, like Hamilton, owes more to the jazz of the 1930s than to bebop or any later jazz styles.
Over the last 15 years, Warren Vache has quietly developed one of the prettiest brass sounds in jazz. Vache's main inspiration is 1930s swing music, where the emphasis was on showcasing a melody and projecting a rich instrumental sound. On most of his new ballad album, Warm Evenings on the Concord Jazz label, He's accompanied by the Beaux-Arts String Quartet, not to be confused with the better-known Beaux-Arts Trio. Jazz soloists and string sections can work together, but the sound of this quartet is pretty soupy. Vache uses a fairly heavy vibrato for modern jazz, but it's no match for those strings. That's With the Wind and the Rain in Your Hair by Clara Edwards and Jack Lawrence, one of a few lesser-known ballads Vache plays. His brass tone is so mellow, those strings ought to smother him. Actually, they enhance his sound. The contrast between the soloist and the strings is the difference between lyricism and mawkishness. Warren Vache's ability to rise above those strings is all the more remarkable given the instrument he plays, cornet, which was the standard lead horn in jazz before Louis Armstrong switched to trumpet in the mid-1920s. Most cornet players quickly followed suit. Lately, though, a few brass players, among them Butch Morris, Olu Dara, and Graham Haynes, have rediscovered the darker tone of the stubbier horn. The cornet sound is less bright than trumpet, but more warm and full. In Vache's case, the difference in timbre sets him apart from his trumpeter heroes, like ballad expert Bobby Hackett. Vache really exploits his horn's resources, manipulating his Harmon mute on Billy Strayhorn's A Flower is a Lovesome Thing. String quartet is missing from a few cuts on Vache's new album. On those tracks, he's joined by a straight jazz trio, which blends so well, I keep hearing a phantom rhythm guitar I know isn't really there. The illusion is caused by the combination of drummer Giampaolo Biaggi's shuffle rhythms with pianist Ben Aronov's tight chords. The bassist is Lincoln Milliman. Here's the quartet on Harry Warren's Summer Night. Thank you. Those straight-ahead tracks break up all the slow, string-laden ballads. But for me, Warren Vache could get up in front of a kazoo band, and he'd still play moving music.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Warren Vache's new album, Warm Evenings, on Concord Jazz. This is Fresh Air. Writer Sue Grafton is the creator of Private Eye, Kinsey Milhone. Milhone is, quote, 32, twice married, no kids, and currently unattached and likely to remain so given my disposition, which is cautious at best. Grafton's first Milhone novel, A is for Alibi, was published in 1982. It was followed by B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse. She's worked her way up the alphabet to her newest, F is for Fugitive. The first Kinsey Milhone novel ended with her facing a moral crisis. She killed someone in self-defense. She says, "The shooting disturbs me still. It has moved me into the same camp with soldiers and maniacs. I never set out to kill anyone. I'll recover, of course. I'll be ready for business again in a week or two, but I'll never be the same."
What I am interested in doing, aside from the fact of the mystery itself, is talking about its effect on Kinsey Milhone. One of the things that always seemed true of me of mysteries in general is the prime character, the protagonist, seems not to be affected by the murder and mayhem. And I wanted to use Kinsey Milhone not only as a way of observing society, but showing her reaction and the changes it brings about in her own personality. So I think you'll see her grow and change because of the violence.
When you started writing detective fiction, were you self-conscious about being a woman and self-conscious about figuring out how to make this a more feminist crime series than a macho one?
No, I was self-conscious, but primarily because I was ill at ease with some of the technicalities of writing detective fiction. When I started A is for Alibi, I didn't even know what a private investigator did. So in the course of writing that book, I did a lot of reading on forensics and California criminal law, ballistics, auto and theft and burglary and that sort of thing. And I think my self-consciousness was the sense of not being qualified to do the writing. And one of the reasons I made Kinsey Milhone female is because I felt like that was an area in which I had a little expertise.
What other kinds of research did you have to do before you felt confident in writing a convincing crime story?
I learned to shoot a handgun. I took women's self-defense. All of the books take me down dark alleys. For instance, when I did See Us for Corpse, I went to visit two morgues so that I would know what that looked like. I did a ride-along with the police in Santa Barbara one night, and that was a bit of an eye-opener because I tend to go to bed very early, and to see what goes on in that town after 10 o'clock was sort of astonishing.
Now, it's interesting. Your detective, Kinsey Milhone, has no family. Her parents were killed in a car accident when she was 5 years old. And I'd like to read something that she says in F is for Fugitive, your new book.
All right.
Now, in this scene, she's having dinner with a family. They're all pretty crazy in this family. And she says, "As a child, I didn't experience much in the way of family. and I usually find myself somewhat taken aback to see one at close range. The Donna Reed Show, this was not. People talk about dysfunctional families. I've never seen any other kind. You know, one of the things I always find interesting in most detective novels is that the character has kind of given up on the idea of family.
Mm.
They don't have any expectations for it.
All right. Well, I know Kinsey will never marry again. She will never have children. But part of that is because I think the tradition of the hard-boiled private eye is that of a loner, the sort of knight-errant. And in part, I made those choices because in the writing of detective fiction, I didn't want to stop and deal with Aunt Maudie and Uncle Herman and everybody gathered around. So she has a sort of surrogate family in Henry Pitts and Rosie, the woman who owns the tavern in her neighborhood. But I didn't want to deal with family gatherings at Christmas time and that sort of thing. So it is a choice I made, and I feel it's the correct one in terms of the kind of book I'm writing.
When you started this series, how did you come up with the A is for alibi, and did you think at the time that you would be committing yourself to a B, C, D, E, F, and so on?
It had been in the back of my mind to try a series based on something. So A is for Alibi came out of a personal situation of my own in which I was going through a very bitter divorce. And at the time, I was not very effectual as a fighter. I have since learned quite a lot about how to fight legal battles. But I used to lie awake at night and think of ways to kill the man. However, because I am such a law-abiding little bun, I knew I'd get caught at it. For one thing, I think the cops are very smart. I think people are foolish who imagine they can outwit the police. And I am the sort of person who does not even turn a library book in late. Also, if I get a parking ticket, I know they're discussing me down at the police station. And that makes me uncomfortable. So I decided that the next best thing would be to take the murder, put it in a book, and get paid for it. And in essence, I have launched an entire new career for myself out of mere homicidal rage.
Each of your books has an epilogue in which Kinsey Milhone files her report.
Yes.
And in the report is usually something of a summing up, but that she also always tells how much money she made.
Yeah.
And how much of an advance she was given and how much money she might have to give back when that's the case. But, yeah, she makes like $1,000, $2,000, maybe $3,000. It's so little money when you think of all she's put on the line to solve this case.
She keeps her monthly nut quite modest. And what I need to talk about in that is that she is a professional. She does work for money. Many of the male detectives simply work for the spirit of it, which I don't think is very realistic in this day and age. I see Kinsey as capable and competent, and I think she should be paid for what she does. On the other hand, I don't want her to have to take money if she doesn't feel right about a case, so I like to keep her liberated in that respect.
You know, we were talking earlier about being a woman writing crime fiction in which there's a woman detective. There's a group called Sisters in Crime, which is an organization of women who write crime novels. And from what I understand, you've decided not to join.
That's right. And I'll tell you some of my reasons. I'm so happy you asked me that. For starters, I don't think writing is gender related. And I prefer to keep the politics out of writing. I see us as one group. I see our problems as applying to all of us, whether we're male or female. I also don't think I need to join a group to show that I am pro-women. And I suspect, too much of a rebel, and Kinsey is too much of a renegade to connect myself to any group. I'm tired of getting people's newsletters. You know, every time you join a group, they send you this crappy newsletter, and I just don't want to do that anymore. I want to keep the writing pure for that, you know?
Well, it's funny you should say that. A friend of mine who reads a lot of crime fiction always thinks it's very funny that any detective writer who spends their days and nights writing about loners would care to join an organization.
That's right. That's right.
But do you find, though, that your concerns as a woman writer are ever at odds with some of the men in the crime writing profession?
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I have found the men in Mystery Writers of America some of the warmest, most supportive people. I don't like to get into the us against them mentality, and I don't, in truth, think that's what Sisters in Crime is saying. I don't think they're maintaining that it is the men in MWA who are the enemy. I think their concerns are related to reviewers and critics and publishers and that sort of thing. But to my way of thinking, the book business is about selling books. And it seems to me if you are a writer who earns money for a publisher, you will be treated well.
Was there a time when you would have joined Sisters in Crime if for no other reason than to not alienate other women in it?
Yeah, see, but that did go through my mind, too, because when I first understood I wasn't going to do it, it scared me silly. But I thought, wait a minute, these people don't have any power over me, and I'm not going to do things in my life anymore just because of the way it looks. If I don't believe it, I'm not going to do it. But I am not the only one, you know. I am not the Lone Ranger out there. There are many other women who were feeling pressured by the organization and who determined that they also did not want to join. We just haven't formed a group because we don't like groups.
Have you found that Kinsey Millhone's courage is contagious?
Yes. Often I find that I look at the world through her eyes, and I think to myself, Kinsey Millhone would not be intimidated, and therefore, whether it scares me or not, I had better straighten up my act.
Sue Grafton, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sue Grafton's latest Kinsey Millhone mystery is F is for Fugitive. It's published by Henry Holt. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll have reports from my two co-hosts from two sides of the world. Noah Adams is in the American West, where the six states in the northern tier are celebrating their centennials. He's taking a train today from St. Paul to the North Dakota border. And John Itzde will be reporting on the economic slump in his native state of North Dakota. We also will have, from Berlin, Robert Siegel reporting on East Germany's new prime minister, Hans Modrow. We'll have a series of reports from Berlin, and both my co-hosts will continue broadcasting all this week from the far-flung points of the compass. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Two new period miniseries are beginning this Sunday on two competing networks. TV critic David Bianculli compares the productions.
That's the theme of one of two miniseries premiering this weekend, and the theme of today's commentary is that theme. It's the theme to Till We Meet Again, a five-hour miniseries based on the novel by Judith Krantz. The weekend's other miniseries is a four-hour version of A Tale of Two Cities, based on the novel by Charles Dickens. A Tale of Two Cities stars Jean-Pierre Aumont, John Mills, and a cast of talented unknowns. Till We Meet Again stars Mia Sara, Barry Bostwick, Lucy Gutteridge, and a cast of untalented knowns. Guess which miniseries is on CBS and which one is on Masterpiece Theater. Or, to put it another way, guess which one is a TV treat and which one is TV trash. There's no time to discuss everything that's bad about Till We Meet Again. But since its musical soundtrack is the first thing that drove me crazy and is indicative of the lack of imagination of the entire miniseries, let's stick with that. No matter where you turn in Till We Meet Again, you face the music. It's there at the beginning when Eve, played by Lucy Gutteridge, sets up what amounts to a 5-hour flashback.
It had rained the night before, and the vines full of grapes gleamed in the sunlight. Paul, proud as ever, looked so handsome as he took the lead. After nearly 40 years together, through 2 wars and the birth of 2 fine girls, in this magnificent moment, I couldn't help but look back to when it all started, when I was a girl in Dijon.
It's there when Eve, as a young girl, is seduced by her first young man. He takes her to a private stateroom on a train, closes the door, carries her to the bed, and starts to caress and undress her. Meanwhile, this is playing. And as her stockings get lower, the music gets higher. After her train ride, Eve goes to an audition at the Barbizon Music Hall. And you know what? The song she sings is one that I know I've heard somewhere before.
My heart is whispering your name. My love is calling once again.
And this is no chorus girl.
And before you can say deja vu times two, it's opening night, and she wows the crowd with, ready? Doesn't the Geneva Convention outlaw torture like this? I mean, this is all in the first half hour. Till We Meet Again and its dumb theme keeps going and going and going, and viewers should go too. To A Tale of Two Cities on Masterpiece Theater, which has an infinitely better story, infinitely better acting, and an infinitely better theme song.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerow. Our engineers are Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Audrey Vublaitis. Chris Burgin directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Julia Child tells us how she learned classic French cooking and how she went on to teach the rest of us. Also, we meet Gus Van Sant, director of the new film Drugstore Cowboy, starring Matt Dillon as a junkie. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.
It's 8 o'clock on 91 FM. Good evening. My name is Melinda Whiting, and our engineer tonight for Evening Classics is Dan Laughlin. We'll be with you until 11 o'clock. On the program tonight, some music for horn and piano by Richard Strauss, also a piano concerto of Brahms, his second, played by Maurizio Pollini, and the Beethoven Opus 111 piano sonata.